Well, this is The Stallion Gate is a quite unusual novel and a departure from the previous one that I had read, Gorky Park. Before we talk about Stallion Gate, I'd like to ask some questions about you and your background. This is your, Stallion Gate must be your fifth novel, right?
Well, it must be, well, somewhere. I mean, it could be 25th. It could be somewhere between 25 and over novels. I wrote a whole lot of books under many different names.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Because I've been writing for almost 20 years, writing novels. And I would do all these things, you know, I'd do westerns, I'd do novelizations. I mean, I was in New York, I was scrambling to stay afloat. So I'd write a whole bunch of westerns, and I'd write a novelization of the Adventures of the Wilderness Family. You know, I did everything. And then I did a couple of gypsy novels that were the first hardbacks that I did, gypsy detective novels. And then I got a publisher to go along with the idea for a Russian, an American detective goes to Russia. And then I went to Russia, and it came to me, the most obvious idea was not to do an American detective in Russia, but to do a Russian detective in Russia. And that's how Gorky Park started, and that's when I started to find out if I could really write or not.
All right, now wait, let's go back to day one. Where did that begin for you?
Day one?
Day one.
Oh, well, my mother's from New Mexico, and my father's from Pennsylvania, except they were jazz musicians, so they moved all over. They lived here in the village. I lived in Central Park West. I lived in the village.
Where were you born?
And I was born in Reading, Pennsylvania. This is where my father's from. And they were trying to make it as musicians there, but they had to come to New York. They met, in fact, in New York at the New York World's Fair of 1939. My mother was an Indian representing the state of New Mexico. And my father was an usher in the Festival of Gas, which is one of the most badly named feature events I can imagine. But so they were musicians. My mother came up from New Mexico actually to learn classical singing. She had a very nice voice. But one of her best friends from the University of New Mexico was a pianist named John Lewis, who later started the Modern Jazz Quartet. And my father was here, and he was following Charlie Parker around the streets. And so they stayed here and tried to work here. And then they went back to New Mexico, so I lived there for a while. It's very tough to make a living in New Mexico jazz.
Not if you can bankroll a club.
No, you've got to do that. That's the only way.
Even if there's only one club in Mexico.
Yes.
In Mexico.
Yeah.
Now I can see why. I can see now why there are so many jazz and musical elements to Stallion Gate, with that musical heritage of your mother and father.
Well, they tried so long, so hard to make me into a musician, and it never took. I got to the point where I actually could play. I could play biding my time all the way through. And that was as far as I got. That was after 6 years. So they finally gave up and decided that I was creatively a dead end.
But Reading, Pennsylvania, how did they get there?
Well, that's where my father was from. My grandfather was an executive, when being an executive meant something, in the gas company. Hence, when my father dropped out of college, my grandfather was able to slip him up to the World's Fair as an usher. So they started there, and they really spent this sort of, in a way, the same sort of pattern I followed, in that when they began their sort of real adult lives, they came to New York. As when I got out of college, it's sort of you start your real adult life and you're responsible for yourself and you've got to make a living. I came to New York.
Where do you consider home, or where did you grow up?
I grew up mainly in Philadelphia, but I spent some years in New Mexico and continued. I sort of find that I spend more and more time in New Mexico as time goes by. My parents have returned to New Mexico and live outside Santa Fe, and I have a lot of relatives down there. My grandmother was an unusual woman, responsible for a great and an enormous family entirely by herself, as if she were some sort of queen bee. She had 23 children. And she had four husbands, went through them, buried them all.
One at a time,
please. So I have this enormous family when I go back to New Mexico as a result. I have cousins beyond number. So I had lived with my grandmother, in fact, in New Mexico, and...
She is an Indian.
Yes.
As your mother,
as is my mother.
Apache?
Pueblo. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather was actually a Yaqui Indian out of Mexico, and my grandmother was a Pueblo Indian out of New Mexico. So it's actually a little bit of a mix, but with a fair amount of Spanish. I mean, when I walked through the door, you didn't say, "Here comes an Indian."
No,
you said, "Here comes."
I would assume
Smith.
That Cruz is your mother's name.
It's actually my grandmother's name. Because I could have used Lopez, but I was, you know, I wrote for a long time. The couple of books I did were under Martin Smith, and then I discovered there were seven other writers in New York named Martin Smith, and that we all seemed to be a generic Martin Smith under the books in print. So I wanted to put something else in there, and I wanted something short. Cruz is about as short as you can get.
Now, where did you go to college?
The University of Pennsylvania. I started off as a sociologist, and then I flunked statistics and looked for something a lot easier. And tried creative writing.
That's easier?
That's a lot easier. Because writing was so simple. I mean, writing was simply writing down what you saw. And there seemed to be statistics and sociology were so much work. But writing down what you see, there seemed to be no hitch in between, particularly writing down. It's as if you have some kid, and he spends all his time, he's 5 years old, he spends all his time drawing, and he just is constantly doing it, and then later he gets to college and he tries to go into sociology and he can't do it, and they say, well, then you're going to have to go back to drawing. It's a very natural thing. I went back to drawing, back to writing, which had always been fun, and I was allowed to do it as a major.
Now, obviously there were jazz elements to your childhood. Were there also literary overtones?
No. My parents were literate. They had each spent some time at college, but were not in the least academic. There was nothing literary at all in my background. It was purely music, which is why it is so strange now for me to be able to do Stallion Gate and take that music, which I couldn't play, and turn it out as words.
Yeah, I grew up in a similar background, I guess. I grew up with Reader's Digest magazines and Reader's Digest condensed books.
Yes. I remember those. I remember thinking they were great. At a certain age, they were fiction to me, and they were short, understandable, digestible stories. And then at the age of 14, I discovered there was Evelyn Waugh, there was George Orwell, and there was this whole other world of writing, which allowed you to make this whole enormous stride, and the world opens up suddenly.
I didn't know they edited out all the good stuff from the Reader's Digest condensed books.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah,
I would love to go back and get just that material that was taken out.
Yeah, they take out all the sex and violence.
Yes.
You don't get any of that. As I found out years later, I didn't know I was being cheated by the Reader's Digest.
Yes.
Well, what happened? What year did you graduate from the University of Pennsylvania?
I graduated in 64, and
that was Barry Goldwater's year.
Yeah. I came out. There was of course this totally different world in which men actually wore magic jackets, and came out and found that having a creative writing major was perhaps the most useless distinction on earth. And my first job, let's see, I got a job as a sports editor at a local newspaper for $75 a week. But I did everything. Being a sports editor meant I also wrote the obits, did the political commentary. I did everything. And then I wanted to, I felt this was interesting to a degree, but I wanted to see more of the world. I wanted to go to Europe and live in Italy and live in Spain. And I couldn't do that on the money I made as a newspaper reporter, so I quit that after a while and became a good humor man and sold popsicles and made three times as much money and did leave that and did go and live in Spain just in my popsicle earnings.
Well, what did you do there?
Well, I went to Spain and tried to paint. At that time, I still thought that I might be able to paint. I was a creative writing major in college because I was so lazy. It was just the easiest thing to do. And I always thought I would do something else. So I went to Spain, and I painted and painted and painted. At the end of it, came to the conclusion I wasn't very good. And I came back and, looking around, fell into the AP for a short time, the Associated Press, again, because I could take the... I was a terrible reporter, but I did very well in their aptitude test, in which they give you some facts and you write a story. So it's like, you know, it's like writing a little story.
So you became an AP writer.
I became an AP writer.
Here in New York?
No, I was in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And the only reason they have reporters in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, is because it's the state capital. Mm-hmm. And so I, who was very good at turning out small featurettes, was suddenly sent to hear about the state budget. And I would sit there and I would literally fall asleep as the governor of Pennsylvania was describing the state budget. And he had this great big chart, and it was all the money came apparently in pies, and he sliced up the pies. And I couldn't follow this. I couldn't follow it and stay awake. So I was short-lived as an AP reporter, went to Philadelphia to the Daily News, where they allowed me to do much more feature kind of material, and then came up to New York. This sounds as if many years are passing. In fact, months are passing from job to job.
Well, what happened in New York?
In New York, I worked for a company called, place called Magazine Management. I had my own magazine there. It was called For Men Only. For Men Only now sounds like this incredible, prurient magazine.
In fact, it was stag.
It was male, it was men, it was for
your own magazine?
Well, I ran it so to speak, there was a staff of two. First I was the junior guy, then I was the senior guy. A staff of two, you're a man of great importance no matter what. So I had this magazine that had girls in it. It had a centerfold, but there were girls in bathing suits. Now it seems so silly to have a centerfold when with somebody dressed, but that was the standard of the day.
Mm.
So I would turn out, I would run this magazine and not be paid very much. But I had the advantage as the editor of buying material from writers. And it turned out a great many of the writers were me. I had a steady marketplace for myself as a writer, so I would be any number of different writers.
You had various pseudonyms.
Yes. Yeah. And I had these great pseudonyms. One of my pseudonyms was a guy named Saul Roman. And I could picture Saul Roman. Saul Roman is a great big beefy guy, a little gorn, a little bald on top, but enormous mats of hair in his chest, great biceps.
A biker, basically.
He
from a mixed
biker.
Marriage.
Yes. Yes. There was him, and there was Ted Irish. There was the doctor, eminent doctor, Emil Korngold was another one of my names. So I had all these different strange persona. It was a strange place to work, and that the place was small and bizarre. And full of good writers. There was Bruce J. Friedman was one of the editors there. Mario Puzo worked there.
Oh yeah.
So it was a sort of a stable. Of people.
And you were the editor of that.
They worked in their magazine, and at the desk over there, and I worked on this desk over here.
And then we each had different magazines.
Yeah, well, we just about did have different magazines.
Mm-hmm.
Because there were only two men. You know, each magazine had a two-man staff.
Mm-hmm.
It was a strange little world in which all of these fairly talented people met as sort of a way station for their careers or what they believed were going to be their careers.
Yeah, Bruce was telling me about his tour on that publication, but I didn't know it was related to yours.
They were all in the same hall.
It was a different magazine, but
yeah,
part of the same
yes.
group. Well, are those magazines still around?
I don't know. I don't know. I haven't seen them. I think as we moved into a much more, actually wilder, more permissive age, a certain zaniness of that period has disappeared. And there was an enormous amount of what we used to run stories about madcap millionaires and how to get rich in Saudi Arabia.
The Freemans were very macho, he was telling me. He used to create a lot of battles.
You know. Oh, yes. You're always how I broke into Stalin's love nest, that kind of story. Which meant if you had a taste for the bizarre, you were allowed, you were asked to go, you know, run rampant.
Good stuff.
It was really weird stuff, and we were constantly, we would do pictures about drug busts, And one of us would be an FBI agent, and then the other guy would be the mafia kingpin holding, you know, hiding his face with his hand, or we'd do Bigfoot. Bigfoot was fun. One of us would get into a gorilla outfit and go into Central Park, while a photographer chased him. I mean, this was, you can find this stuff.
Well, now you had a stable of pseudonyms. Did you start using these pseudonyms for other stuff rather than the magazine at this point?
Well, I was fired. That was my last. Honest employment, so to speak.
Well, they get tired.
That was as honest as my employment.
They got tired of the Bigfoot stories.
They wanted to change it. They wanted to make it less. It seemed to me less fun, more bizarre, little. They wanted to have more sex in the magazine, of all things. These times were changing. A consultant came in. And so they had to have a little bit more hardcore sex.
Take off the bathing suits.
Yeah, exactly. I got into a confrontation with the consultant, threw him out of the office the following afternoon, and at noon I was thrown out of the building.
Well, you had to do that coming from an Ivy League school.
Yes, yes. I had my, oddly enough, you never know you have standards until suddenly, the day before Christmas, you're fired.
Oh, my goodness, what happened then?
Then I went to Portugal to write. I decided just to write.
You were tired of your previous tour in Spain, so you decided to go next
door. Well, Portugal was even cheaper than Spain. By then I was married. And I was looking for, you know, that giving myself as much of an element of safety as possible. So I went to Portugal, lived in a wonderful house, overlooking the ocean, and wrote one of the worst books ever not published. But on the way back from Portugal, I made sort of a swing through France and met a friend from the old magazine, who was now at a publishing house, who had asked me if I had a book, because he needed books now. And so I promised him a book. That was the first book I did have published and have published since then.
Well, what was that book? And who wrote
that? I wrote that under my own name. That was one of the most of them I didn't. That one I did. And it was called The Indians Won. And you can sort of imagine what the plot of the book is. It was fun. Parts of it were very nicely done.
A Western?
And it started in 1876. And with the Battle of Little Bighorn, and then documented in sort of a pseudo-historical fashion how the Indians won that confrontation and how the middle of the country continues to be Indian territory.
This was a paperback.
This was a paperback.
And what year?
This was distinctly a paperback.
Yeah. What year did that come out? Do you recall?
That must have been about 1968.
So that was your first published work.
And then I did a couple of gypsy novels, which did well.
Those were published by Putnam, as I recall.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And, they did well. They became a book club selection.
Yeah. And they were published in Europe. And so there was some indication, in fact, that I was going to be able, that I could write if I really put myself to it. And then I got involved with Gorky Park and
ran at Nightwing.
Well, see, now Gorky Park started way back.
Before Nightwing?
Long before Nightwing. Because I then got a contract and went to Moscow to check out the story of a detective. An American detective, but I was in Moscow and I thought, this is crazy. Why do this again? Why again do a story about an American detective? Why not do it as a Russian detective? And so when that revelation came upon me that I changed the whole nature of the book. The publisher did not agree with this revelation. He thought it was simply perhaps a good idea, but one I probably would not be able to pull off, because he just seemed to the difficulties about doing it seemed insurmountable to him. By any reasonable standard, he was most likely right. But I insisted on doing it, and so we disagreed. And then came a long period of me trying to buy my book back and him insisting on publishing the book, although he wasn't enthusiastic about it, insisted on publishing it. And so this disagreement meant that there was going to be no Gorky Park, no Russian novel. And so I had to divide my time until I could. I'd learned one thing about steady employment. People get fired. The thing about writing is you may starve, but you don't get fired. So if I could outlast the people at the publishing house...
You can.
And you can.
Yeah, they change every week. Well, who was the publisher that you dealt with during this formative period for Gorky Park?
That first period was Putnam's.
Uh-huh.
And I can understand why they, you know, why they were so scared about what I was doing. Because, he was this kid who insisted on writing a Russian novel with their money. I'd given them an outline about an American detective, and suddenly I changed my mind. And I was doing a Russian detective. They were saying, well, if you really will insist on doing it differently from the way you told us you were going to do it, then go ahead and we'll publish it. But we do insist on publishing it. We have a contract with you for this book, and we want to have the book. And my attitude was that I was not going to write something as important as that to me for them to publish it without enthusiasm.
They would have dumped it.
Yeah. And so I wanted to buy it back. But both of us stood on principle and meant that nothing happened at all. And so in the meantime, I had to keep going. And so I would write a Western a month. And I would just do whatever came to hand. Which meant some Westerns. I did a paperback series of espionage called the Inquisitor, about a man who killed for the Pope. And it was an idea a little bit ahead of its time. It will probably always be ahead of its time, and then that time will go when I'm not looking, and then it'll be behind its time. But it was an interesting series in that it was fun, and each book sold less than the one before.
How did you resolve the difficulty with Putnam?
Well, one by one, the editorial staff at Putnam's changed. And then the day came when there was an entirely new editorial staff, and they said, what is this contract? What is this ancient contract doing here? You really want to buy it back? It's yours. And so by this time, I had done Nightwing. Finally, I had Nightwing done. And Nightwing I had done because I was getting mad about not making money. I was finally fed up with the fact that I was apparently going about this writing business all wrong. And I wrote that with the most commercial impulse, which was to pay a stack of bills that were holding up the short leg of my desk. And when I had done Nightwing, I had enough money then to finish Gorky Park. So that's, at that same time, I finally was able to buy it back. Finally, they allowed me to buy it back.
Well, Gorky Park, of course, was I guess you would have to consider that your breakthrough book. It certainly caught the imagination of both readers and critics. And it also became a very good film, although they changed it. The Russian detective did not go to New York in the film, but the movie still worked pretty well, I thought. I don't know how...
No, I'm glad you did. I wasn't too crazy about it.
No, most writers don't like the.
I'll tell you, you write a novel, you write this, you take all this trouble to create this immense thing, this whole story of great size, with as much life as you can possibly put into it, and as many people full of life as you can possibly put into it. And then they say, okay, now we're going to fit this with this thing, which is like the size is as big as a giraffe, big as an elephant, whatever. We're going to fit it through a door big enough for a midget, which means they start cutting things off. And they don't care so much what they cut off as long as it finally fits through that tiny door. So you see character go. You don't just see people, the sort of cast of characters going, but you see, for example, in the book, Arkady Renko was a man, as Russians often tend to be, of some real warmth and liking for his fellow humans. And that's one of the first things you see that go. So instead of having a man of some dimension, a character of some dimension, you have a character which is another cold repeat of sort of a cold, unfeeling Russian, which was totally the opposite of the idea of the book.
One thing I think the movie did, another thing where they cut that I don't think they should have, was the recreation of the faces and skulls mm-hmm. that was done so nicely in the book, and they kind of sloughed that off in the movie, I think.
Well, I can understand why they had to trim that down. What bothered me was, if you're not going to come back to the United States, if you're not going to come to New York from Moscow, then why go to Stockholm? The whole point of leaving Moscow is only to come to New York to present and give ourselves some mirror image of a sort of the two societies, America and Russia. Not to give us a mirror image of Sweden and Russia. That does us no good at all. That's not very interesting to us.
Well, Martin Cruz Smith, let's go on to the Stallion Gate, which is a major departure from Gorky Park. You obviously did a lot of research in trying to create the atmosphere of the period and the events leading up to the test of that first atom bomb. What led you to select this period to write about?
Well, I sort of found myself forced into it. I wanted to do something. I wanted to come back and write a book that was American. I didn't want to do another Russian novel. Having done that, to do the same dance again wouldn't be interesting for me, and it wouldn't be interesting for you. And then I decided if I was going to do something American, I really enjoyed New Mexico. I felt I knew something about that. And so I started a contemporary New Mexican story. And I tried to do that for a year. And it was a nice story. And it was about geothermal development in the mountains of New Mexico. And it had some very nice scenes to it. But as I was driving about, I would talk to people, and they one of them mentioned one time that her aunt used to work at Los Alamos, and that every morning at about 5:30, an army bus would come down and take them up to this secret place where the little Indians worked, as menials, as maids, as people sweeping, as stokers in the furnaces. But they were the people that kept Los Alamos running. And it was the first time I'd known that then this secret laboratory was staffed with Indians, with Pueblo Indians. And I thought, that's an interesting sentence. And then as I began developing the story, I thought, well, that's really worth more than a sentence. That's at least a paragraph. And then as I worked more in the story, I thought, well, maybe a flashback, because it's really good. And I was pursuing the story down in the Mescalero Reservation at one point, and taking that road between the Mescalero Reservation and back to Socorro, New Mexico. And I was on the highway, and I saw a sign that said Stallion Gate, 3 miles. And I thought, it was sort of faintly familiar, and I didn't know why. And then I came to the Stallion Gate. It's nothing but a barbed wire fence and a road that goes through it, a break in the barbed wire fence and a road. And again, it said Stallion Gate. And I realized I had been driving along the White Sands Missile Range all this time, this big sweep on my left. And I started asking about Stallion Gate, because there was something familiar about it, and that was the point I learned, that was where you have to go through to go to Trinity. And the more I asked about it, the more it became apparent that Stallion Gate, in fact, that break in the fence, had been there before there was a Trinity. Before, it was just a gate that led to a ranch. But this was the ranch that was appropriated by the Army about 1944 to set off the first plutonium bomb that was created in Los Alamos, about 150 miles north in northern New Mexico. And suddenly, that year spent doing a contemporary story was suddenly gone in a day. It was just... I was sort of hanging on to it for a day after a year you don't want to hang on to part of it, but it was all, by the end of the day, I just cast it all aside.
I would assume that it's historically accurate, all of the events involving.
Some of the most incredible things are the truest. For example, it's a recreation of Los Alamos in 1945. It's a recreation of the physicists who are doing it, but it is told for the first time with the point of view of an Indian, not a physicist, an Indian who's working there. one of the first things that people find hard to believe is that Indians worked there, but that's what led me into the book to begin with.
Tell me a little bit about Joe Pena. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Pena.
Who is your hero, a bigger-than-life man, an Indian. Tell me a little bit how this characterization developed.
Well, I wanted somebody to be Indian and yet not totally reservation bound, not somebody who didn't know anything about the outside world. So I needed somebody who had left the reservation when he was younger. I wanted somebody who was connected to the traditional reservation life, and I made him the son of a famous potter. And I wanted somebody who was big and handsome, an attractive man. No, because I'd always wanted to do a giant to begin with. I thought that would be an interesting thing to do. But he was totally a creation, and only later did people come to me and say that you must have patterned it after so-and-so. And the first time I became aware of a man named Popovi Day, who was a great, big, handsome guy who was in the army, who was Atlas Alamos, who was in the army, who was from the local Pueblo, and who was the son of Maria, the famous potter. So it's very strange when you create somebody as unique as you think he is, and then find out that there was such a person. He was a major character among these characters I've taken from the past, but he was a fictitious character, and then to find there is another connection there is interesting, at least. Joe has been a fighter, and he is a musician. And I wanted very badly to get the sense of the music of 1945. Because you start thinking about how do you bring 1945 to life? How do you bring a year 40 years ago back? And you can't do it just with just some images, and you can't do it just with tricks of dialogue.
Of course, Joe had some concern about being able to sell booze, being an Indian. I would assume the old liquor laws are no longer in effect in New Mexico as related to Indians.
But they are in some places.
They are?
Yeah. There are lots of places where you can't sell drinks to Indians.
Just to Indians or don't you?
Just Indians.
Was that right?
Yeah. I mean, at least until recently. Maybe they changed in very recently, but certainly a lot of those laws still hold.
You have a great boxing scene in there, too. You've really got a little bit of everything in there, all the elements of a great suspense novel. It's not a mystery. It's rather hard to define.
I didn't want to do an ordinary mystery. But to do a mystery, an ordinary mystery, in the shadow of the first atomic bomb seemed to me sort of a waste of time. What I wanted was, I wanted an enormous amount of excitement. I wanted characters who were large, and Joe, I tried to make very large for a reason, because Joe, I wanted to make immense, immensely talented, immensely attractive, but at the same time, Joe says it very well, in fact. Joe says, compared to someone like an Oppenheimer or a Fuchs, I'm nothing. I'm nobody. I am the least important person here on the Hill. Which is what everybody in Los Alamos called it, the Hill. And he says, I'm the least important person here, I'm nothing. And compared to, finally, the effect, the outcome of the bomb, he's right. I wanted somebody big enough, with big enough shoulders to carry all the rest of us, with him and see everything that happens, and at the same time come to that realization of exactly what is happening. At Los Alamos, what is being created?
Well, it's a terrific book, Martin Cruz Smith, and I congratulate you for it. Just kind of wrap things up a little bit. Tell me about your current life. You abandoned New York for
former client? Not totally abandoned New York. Right now I'm having my apartment. I kept my apartment like a man keeps one, he goes as far out in the water as he can, but he still clings to one rope. And so I've kept my apartment in New York just so I can maintain a life in New York. It's as if, part of my brain is still in a safety deposit box in Manhattan. So I try to maintain it, but I do live in Northern California.
Whereabouts?
Well, I have exchanged my air shaft, which is what I used to live next to, for some redwoods north of San Francisco.
Mm. Well, my last question then, what can we expect next from Martin Cruz Smith?
Well, more confusion. More. people were expecting, I think, another Russian novel, and they get an American novel, and they say, "What is he? Why is he doing this? Why is he always changing course?" And so I think the next time I'll do another 80, 90 degree turn. I don't know myself quite yet what I'm doing, but this is a state of confusion that I don't mind.
Martin Cruz Smith, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Spending this time with me. I usually limit these things to less than half an hour because I have to weed through a lot of tape and we've gone more than 40 minutes.
Yeah.
But you're an interesting guy to talk to and I certainly like the book and thanks a lot for coming.
Thank you for letting me.